You're listening to The Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. Tamika Thompson is the award-winning author of a new gothic horror novel, The Curse of Hester Gardens. She'll be at Bloomsbury Books on April 30th at 7 p.m. for an author talk. Tamika Thompson is the brilliant author of The Curse of Hester Gardens, an incredibly thrilling horror novel that takes place within a unique setting, a public housing project. The story follows a mother navigating the terrifying intersection between gun violence and a supernatural curse. Tamika Thompson is a former journalist and a producer. She's also the author of Unshod, Cackling, and Naked, which received the 2024 Next Generation Indie Book Award for Horror. Her work has appeared in several fiction anthologies, as well as in the New York Times and the Los Angeles Review of Books. Welcome to The Exchange, Tamika.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, to start, can you tell us about your background and how your work as a journalist has provided the foundation for this novel?
This novel really grew out of personal experience, gaining perspective, and research. My personal experience is that I grew up in a high-crime neighborhood at the height of the crack epidemic in Detroit. The book is dedicated to my uncle, who was shot to death when I was young. And my father was a game hunter, and we had several guns in the home for self-defense and sport. And at the age of 4, I picked up a loaded handgun, thinking it was a toy. At the age of 15, I survived an attempted carjacking. And it wasn't until I left home to study political science at Columbia University, really looking at comparative politics, that it became clear to me how America was situated globally when it comes to gun violence. And it gave me perspective on what I had experienced when I was growing up. I then went on to get a master's in journalism from the University of Southern California, where I looked at gang violence. And when I began to work as a journalist at Network News and at a television show on PBS, I started to look at youth violence and gun violence. And the research, which became the underpinning of this book, was really horrific. Gun violence in America is an epidemic and a public health crisis, and it's the leading cause of death for young people in this country. And so when I first started looking at it, it was the second leading cause of death, but it has since overtaken car accidents and cancer to be the leading cause of death in this country for young people. And so that really inspired the book, where the voices from the research, the experts, the numbers, and what had happened to me when I was young.
Wow, this, I got to tell you, this book gripped me because I too grew up in a troubled community, a community deprived of resources, a community at war with itself. The Curse of Hester Gardens connects really to a broad range of life issues. I mean, love, relationships, family and friends, religion, of course, gun violence. But then there's the supernatural and more. How would you summarize it?
I'd say it's a gothic novel set in a public housing project that follows one mother, Nona McKinley, as she faces the twin specters of gun violence and supernatural curse. She's already, by the beginning of the book, raised 3 boys in the Hester Gardens section of Medford, Michigan, and her drug dealer husband is behind bars. And her oldest son, Kendall, has already been shot to death at 18. But her second son, Marcus, is on the right path. He's a valedictorian. He's headed to an Ivy League school. He can get out of their high crime neighborhood. But strange things start happening to her and to other residents in and around Hester Gardens. Her youngest Lance begins hanging with the wrong crowd, the local gang, the Hester Boys. And Marcus, the one that she's hung all of her hopes on, becomes moody and secretive. And he sometimes seems like a completely different person altogether. And so Nona begins to fear that someone or something from her past is seeking revenge because she made a decision, not the greatest decision, in a moment of weakness to protect her family. But the book is about safe neighborhoods versus unsafe neighborhoods, about how expensive it is to be poor, about the way that the poor can be preyed upon by institutions that are supposed to be there to support them. It has all of the makings of a rough, what we consider a rough neighborhood. The education system is underfunded and lacks the resources to train their young people and to teach them. The hospital that is there, Medford Hospital, is referred to as Deadford Hospital because you may go in for something routine and not come out. And the church, which is supposed to be a place of community and support, and it does provide that, is also extracting resources from people who really don't have them. And they're taking those resources to enrich themselves. And in the character of Pastor, you know, he and his wife drive expensive cars. There are plasma screen televisions. There's a beautiful fountain outside, manicured lawns. He's wearing tailored suits. And he's so different from the people who are in Hester Gardens, but has built this wealth from them, from the very congregants who need help.
My guest is Tamika Thompson, author of the horror novel, The Curse of Hester Gardens. Tamika lives in the San Francisco Bay Area, where she hosts her own blog and newsletter, Tamika Talks Terror. Now, Tamika, you characterize these systems as predators that are preying upon the poor, and you center the story on Nona McKinley, as you mentioned, this mother working a 9-to-5 job while trying to protect her sons. Why was it important for you to use the perspective of a mother, specifically an African-American mother, to drive this narrative?
When I was growing up, my grandmother, who had originated in Georgia and had moved to Detroit to work, she worked multiple jobs. She and my mother and my aunt and uncles lived in a public housing project when they were young. My grandmother was eventually able to own her own home, but my uncle was shot to death. And I always wondered how my grandmother absorbed that loss, how she was able to continue to provide for our family, to be a strong matriarch when she had lost one of her children so violently and at a young age. And when I was researching this topic of gun violence, I spoke to a lot of parents, particularly mothers. And you have to keep in mind that when I was researching, I wasn't just researching so-called inner city shootings. I began looking at this after the Sandy Hook shooting in Connecticut, where a number of first graders were shot to death. I thought we were going to have a national conversation on gun violence in America. I thought we were going to reach some sort of consensus, and we really didn't. But I spoke to experts in their field, people at the CDC, not-for-profit, topical leaders, elected officials in cities where they had seen some of their homicide numbers come down. But the voices that haunted me were the mothers. And I spoke to mothers who had lost children to school shootings, mass shootings, so-called gang shootings, so-called inner city shootings in urban, suburban, and rural areas. And those perspectives were very similar, not only of the young people, but of the mothers of the loss. And so when I began writing this book, I had 8 POV characters, and they all were pretty even in the beginning, but those mothers' voices haunted me. And Nona's voice was the one that I ended up turning the volume up a bit in the book, because I felt that readers would be able to connect with her panic, her anxiety, her desperation, having lost one child already, and what that would feel like, what every decision would feel like, what every day would feel like when she knows that she still has these other two boys in the same environment and she can't get them out.
Well, your book contains a poignant quote: "The only ghost here is poverty." Now, how do the supernatural elements in the book serve as a metaphor for institutional violence and generational trauma in America?
There's so much that gets passed down, particularly for poor, marginalized African-American families, that even before you are born, so much has already occurred within your family, so much trauma and so much pain. And there's a spirit within that gets passed down as well. Not all of it is bad. Some of it is a spirit of resistance, of wanting progress, but some of it is that pain and that trauma and that uncertainty. A lot of times within families, we don't have wealth that we can pass down. A lot of families are starting over each generation. And so it raises the question in the book of what the curse actually is. When you live in a place where there are faulty appliances, rodents, roaches, leaky pipes, mold, backed up sewer lines, the trash is not picked up by the private trash collection company with any frequency. And so the actual smell of the trash permeates the fabric of your clothing. And Hester Gardens is positioned right next to the freeway. So there is air pollution in addition to noise pollution. And it begins to beg the question, what is actually the curse here? Is it supernatural? Is it the spirit of the people who have been killed here who cannot leave? Or is it America? Is it the way that America cordons off certain undesirable people and restricts them into housing that is not designed to be beautiful, is not maintained with any frequency? Complaints fall on deaf ears when residents need help. It begs the question, what is this evil? What is this curse? And Hester Gardens becomes a microcosm for the entire country, which is why it is a Gothic novel, because that's what a Gothic novel does, is it takes that place, that setting, that structure that is in disrepair, and it serves as a microcosm for the larger empire that is, in a lot of cases, falling.
So we have a couple of minutes left before we have to take a break. But you also, I mean, you just explained it. You indict the system itself. But at the same time, you're using stereotypical tropes of Black men engaged in underground economies, illicit activities, and young Black men murdering one another in churches who lack power or don't use the power they have.
There are no human villains in this book. And I consistently challenge the notion in the label of criminal. And so we have a character, Peter, who is the leader of the local gang. But in this book, I begin with Peter as a four-year-old boy. And the reason that I do that is because when he is four, he has so many hopes and dreams for who he is going to be in life. He wants love. He knows how to give love. And really wants his grandmother and for Nona to take him in and to shower him with the affection that he can't get from his parents. In the research, what I found is that a character like Peter mimics not only what we see in the stereotypical gang inner city, but also the rural, the suburban, the mass, and the school shooters. That before they ever picked up a gun, they have been traumatized. Something has happened to them. And my indictment is that what has happened to these young people is America.
Okay, let's stop right there. That's a perfect stopping point. We need to take a short break. My guest is Tamika Thompson, author of the horror novel, The Curse of Hester Gardens. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Tamika Thompson, author of the horror novel, The Curse of Hester Gardens. Now, before the break, we were getting some insight into, I guess, a bit of a sociological, anthropological education around what happens to a four-year-old that doesn't get the kind of guidance and nurturing and supports that he needs, not just from the family and the community, but from the systems that are supposedly around the community. And what I heard was an indictment of the system, because there are no four-year-old criminals, right?
Exactly. And we see in the prologue that all of these boys are the same, Nona's boys and Peter, who will grow up to be the leader of the local gang. But by chapter one, they have all changed so much. Some of them have made decisions to pick up guns, to engage in criminal activity, and to be enraged in their daily life. And the answer to that is what has been done to them. When I looked at gang violence, I spoke to actual gang members and former gang members. And it didn't matter whether they were Black gang, Latin gang. This is why I say I don't believe in the criminal label. They have been traumatized at some point. And the same thing was happening with the mass shooters and the school shooters. And so one of the characters in the book, Harlan, who is a journalist, begins to discover some of these connections over the course of the book. His research and his reporting very closely mirrors what I found. And the horror is really that we haven't been able to solve this problem, which at some point we had said it was okay for there to be unsafe neighborhoods. It was okay for the South Side of Chicago, Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland, near where I live. It's okay for shootings to happen in those cities. Those are unsafe cities, and so we will just allow that to happen. But the reality is that they don't only happen there. We allowed it for so long and we kind of turned a blind eye to it that it is now affecting everyone. We're looking at 48,000 Americans killed each year by guns, 32,000 non-fatal gun injuries every year. We own half of the world's civilian-owned firearms. 46% of U.S. households report owning at least one firearm. And so our national interpretation of the Second Amendment makes it so that every citizen has the potential to be a soldier. And we have to ask ourselves whether that's what we really want.
Well, I love the way that you frame this, but then I'm confused about who we are, because when you indict the system, you're indicting people in positions of power, wealth, and influence. And these are the people who allow for conditions of collateral damage that turns four-year-old boys into 14 and 16-year-old people who are committing acts that you wouldn't otherwise want them to commit. It seems like it's by design.
But we are designing it. We elect our officials. We are the public opinion that underpins the power. And so in order for the power structure to change, the people have to decide that we want something different. I brought up the 46% of U.S. households owning at least one firearm. The reason that I bring that up is because public opinion has not changed about gun ownership. The demand for these guns exists and hasn't changed. And so we have to look for additional ways to solve problems while we are pressing for regulation on the guns. So we need to fund our schools in all areas. There cannot be schools that are underfunded and we have just let them go and that's just how it's going to be. And the students that are there are just going to maybe have books or maybe won't. We need safe places for everyone to live. Children need to go to bed at night with food in their bellies. You know, our healthcare system needs to be a place that actually heals and not harms or neglects certain people. So it's a complex problem with complex solutions. But the reason that I indict the system, the reason that I talk about the public opinion that underpins that system, is because I don't think that we're going to get to any of those complex solutions until we start to change people's minds about what the problem is. If we see this as only a problem in a place like Hester Gardens, and we can't see the humanity of the people in Hester Gardens in places that are like it, how are we going to solve this complex problem? And so, you know, you ask, why did I place this here, right? Why am I going to the very place of stereotype? It's because I'm pushing back against the stereotype. It's because I want people to see Peter and to identify with Peter the way that I identify with Peter. I see Nona and Peter on the same continuum, that they're both capable of extreme beauty, but also extreme violence. And I would like for people to see Peter and try to figure out ways that we can get him to tap into that beauty more often and not give him a reason to tap into the violence.
My guest is Tamika Thompson, author of the horror novel, The Curse of Hester Gardens. Tamika lives in the San Francisco Bay Area, where she hosts her own blog and newsletter, Tamika Talks Terror. Now, I've heard you mention a couple of times that we're dealing with complex problems, but as I listen to you, you seem to have boiled these complex problems down to an understanding that we're talking about human value and the value of human lives. And so we know that these kinds of places that you write about, like Hester Gardens, the projects, emerge from, you know, redlining and this system of racial hierarchy, valuing and devaluing humans by this mythological construct of race. And so if that becomes the centerpiece, if we can learn to identify that we are devaluing the lives of these kids, and what happens to them is based upon the fact that we're devaluing their lives and we're putting them in places like Hester Gardens and surrounding them with all kinds of existential circumstances over which they have no control, then we are designing that because we have effectively devalued these people. And that's something that if we can tap into, and I think your book kind of draws us toward that, perhaps there's a solution?
There is definitely a solution. During the research, I spoke to municipal leaders in cities that had brought their homicide numbers down. And what I found is that they kind of threw everything at the problem. That's why I say that the solutions are complex. We just have to make up our mind that we want to do it. They retrained officers for community policing in areas where they were having run-ins with people, with the community, and the community felt that they didn't trust the police. They funded mental health resources in community organizations and at schools. They funded job programs. They made sure that people had food and access to health care. What we're talking about are safe neighborhoods. What we're talking about is a comprehensive solution that looks at multiple things. They did have gun buyback programs they did give people incentives for putting down their arms or getting rid of them. But that wasn't the centerpiece of what they were doing. They were really coming together with people who were leaders in the community, including the church and community organizers, to figure out what are the ways that we can reach people when they are young before they ever pick up a gun. And what I found, because I looked at this by this point over a decade, is when those dollars went away, those numbers did start to creep back up. And so when I say that we have to value all life, I'm talking about marginalized people for sure, but I'm talking about everyone. My children live in a relatively comfortable place compared to where I grew up, but they still are experiencing lockdown drills at school. They still are in peril. At any point, any one of us could be shot. And so when we talk about valuing life, if we don't value the lives of the marginalized, we're really not valuing anyone.
Well, that's well said. One of the unique aspects of Nona's character is her faith. And you mentioned the church being a central piece to this solution, but it's also it's a challenging institution as well. And if we are not engaged in investing in the solution, well, then the alternative becomes the horror story that you tell, and that involves the supernatural as well. Tell me about the role of religion within marginalized communities of color.
I created a faith community for Nona because it resembled so much of what I experienced when I was growing up. My parents sent me to a Catholic school, but on the weekends, we went to a non-denominational church that was very similar to a Baptist church. And it was a mega church, and it had a celebrity pastor. And for my mother, in particular, the church was a place of community, and it was a place of learning. One of the things that for the people in the neighborhood that I lived in was that many of them didn't have a perspective beyond our neighborhood. They had not traveled. They had not, in a lot of cases, been to the other side of the state. And so the church became a place where they could gain new perspective, to have some sort of life experience beyond their immediate neighborhood, to have political power, to be adjacent to the city leaders who would often come in and speak, or other community organizations that would come in. So it's not all bad. It certainly creates community and builds community and allows for resources beyond the neighborhood. But what I became interested in is when that changes, and when that relationship becomes a bit predatory, which it certainly did when I was young, because we didn't have a lot of money. And there was this pressure to give regular tithes and offerings to the church. There were collections that were taken up at every church service. And so I think it's a mixed bag. But so are so many things in America, right? Where there could be something really good beside something that is not so great.
Absolutely.
But I think for Nona, who had grown up in another public housing project on the other side of Medford, this was a place where she, outside of reading books, learned about the world. And in this text, she had to step outside of that faith, outside of that religion, to figure out what was going on with her. And it was in that moment that she began to gain her power.
Well, unfortunately, we have about 30 seconds left, and you've expressed a desire for this book to spark a national conversation. Very quickly, what's the main message you want readers to carry with them after they finish the final chapter?
I want readers to really ask themselves what kind of country we want to have. Do we want all communities to be safe? Do we want all of our children to be safe? And if we do, how do we get there?
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there, and that's a great place to leave it. Thank you, Tamika, for taking my mind on a wild ride.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest was Tamika Thompson, author of the horror novel, The Curse of Hester Gardens. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio.